give me some time to receive the message of being free.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Heather, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has to happen in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight's speaker is Miss Cramby.
Hi, my name's Fran, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm nervous. I usually throw that out there in the beginning and just get that over with. I'm not very good at speaking in front of people. I do this as a form of service, and I've come to not be so nervous about it, you know. It's just part of my life as an alcoholic, telling my story, because for me, getting sober, the most effective part of my recovery was one alcoholic talking to another, sharing the experience and hearing somebody tell my story or parts of my story, hearing people talk and realizing that other people have the same experiences and the same, that thing you can't explain that I do. And there was no way out of realizing that is alcoholism, whatever, at whatever level I understood it at the time, that was alcoholism and that I had it too. And I knew from early on that I was an alcoholic. I knew that I had a drinking problem and I couldn't control it, but it took a lot of coming in here and hearing stories and hearing people share to understand sort of what that was, and that it was a definite, that thing that we can't always explain except through sharing experiences with each other. And so that was real important to me. So I'm always grateful when people ask me to share my story. I always felt like when I was asked to tell my story that I didn't have a very exciting story to tell, because I had what I thought for a long time was a normal upbringing, a normal childhood and a normal family. And because there was no alcoholism in my immediate family, and there was no divorce, and there was none of this drama and abuse and everything that was going on that I heard a lot in other people's stories that they had to deal with growing up. And so I felt like my story was a little bit boring in a way, as far as that was concerned. But it took me a little while of looking back to realize how abnormal my family and my growing up was in that way. And I'm really grateful for that today as well. I grew up in what was then a small town where everybody basically knew everybody. And you grew up with the same people all the time. So you had sort of built-in friends. And I had a lot of brothers and sisters who were all older than me. So I had a built-in support system. And my parents were happily married for 65 years. Didn't have any drama at home. So I didn't have any reason to drink, and I didn't have any reason to ever feel like I was, you know, on the outside looking in, or needed to feel like I needed to drink to fit in with people, because I never even moved out of the house. My parents lived in the same house for 65 years. We were never the new kids in town, or the new kids on the block, or the new kids at school. You know, I never had to do anything. This life was so easy for me, you wouldn't believe it. So I never had to prove myself to anybody or or try to, you know, fit in or live up to anything. So there was never peer pressure to drink or anything. And so I didn't drink, you know, early. And a lot of my friends drank and I didn't, and they didn't care. We would go to things and they had their things to drink, and I didn't drink, and it was no big deal. And so one night we were all going somewhere, football game or something, and I was 15, I guess. And they had something that smelled good to me. So I asked to taste it, you know, it just smelled good. You know, it was that easy. It's like, oh, that smells good, let me try it. And that was it. It was over. So wherever we were going, yeah, we were going to the football game, and so everybody that drank had all their stuff. And so all through the football game, everywhere we went, if anybody sat a drink down, I picked it up and drank it. And not having any idea what it was or where it was, and I did that all night. I stole people's alcohol. I snuck it. I stole it. I drank one of whatever I could get my hand on. And I got really drunk. And so I went home, and I got up the next day, and I didn't have a terrible hangover, and I didn't get sick. And I thought, this is the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. And I've got to figure out how to keep doing it. So of course I lied about, you know, where I'd been and what I'd done. And so the first drink I ever took, I started out stealing, lying, hiding it. You know, it was one drink, flipped the switch, I was off and running. And I was getting people to buy it for me, and I was hiding it in the house, and I was hiding it in the neighborhood. I hid it in a creek down by my house. I would have to slide down an embankment and crawl back. This creek went underneath the road and came out on the other side. And I would just crawl back in that tunnel underneath the road and put it in the water, keep it cold overnight till the next day, go back and get it the next day. And it was in the woods and the creek and the toilet tank and the house and the, you know, it was everywhere. As I got older, the more freedom I got, the more easier it was to get, you know, and so it would just accelerate. As everything got easier, the drinking would accelerate. As I could drive, I'd hide it in the car, I'd be able to get away more. But it was just like lightning fast for me. And everything just kind of changed. That was my priority from that moment on, was to drink for no reason at all except to drink. And it wasn't to be social. It wasn't to fit in. It wasn't, you know, it was just to drink. That was the only reason. And I couldn't explain it. It didn't seem strange to me or anything. It was just, as soon as I had it, I wanted it. I needed it. And it's all I ever thought about. And so that night was like the beginning of the rest of my life. And I just didn't know it yet, you know. I drank alcoholically from that day forward, you know. And so as soon as, the more and more freedom I got, the more alcoholically I drank. And so I went to my first AA meeting when I was 18 years old. And I woke up in a blackout in an AA meeting. And I didn't know how I got there, but it was like, I was just like, oh, wow. And the worst part was there was somebody there that I knew, that knew my parents. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, awkward. But I still don't know, you know, how I got there. I mean, I don't know what motivated me to get there. I don't know if I called myself. I don't know if somebody told me to go there and where the meeting was, or if I called the central office and got the address. I do not know to this day how I ended up in that AA meeting, but I know I drove there because I left and got in my car. It was weird, and And when I realized where I was and who was there and everything, I just wanted to get out. You know, obviously, I was like, this is a bad idea. I know people here. They know my parents. This is going to blow up in my face, you know, and I'm never going to do this again. And I was getting ready to go off to college. And I knew I had a problem. And I was thinking, okay, I'll go to college and I'll just be better, right? How many of you think that worked out for me? That did not work out well at all. I went off to college and it just went, you know. Clearly, I found my people, and they were happy to meet me. We we did well together, and the drinking just went off the chain. And at some point, I think maybe I was a sophomore at college. I was going to AA in the evenings. I was going to outpatient alcohol counseling in the daytime. I was going to college classes, and I was going to these what you call repeat offender classes, is what they call it at night. Now, you are familiar with that?
Yeah.
These are my people. And I had to go there. That was court ordered to stay out of jail. I would have to go there and get my paper signed to finish those classes because I had broken so many little ridiculous laws in town that they didn't quite know what to do with me. Because I had a bad case then of just, I would get just drunk enough to have a really good idea. And then I would go out and try to execute it. And it usually meant that I was going to do something really stupid out in public. And most of my charges involved like public drunkenness or drunken disorderly or something. That was all they could think of to call it. But they didn't know what to do with me anymore. And so in order to stay out of jail, I had to go and get my paper signed and do that. So I was very busy right about then. And I was still drinking. But I knew that I needed to quit drinking. And I knew that I had a problem. And it really scared me because I knew that I could not control what was happening to me. And I was really afraid. But the one thing that I knew more than anything was that I couldn't tell anybody. Shouldn't tell anybody. You know, like my family or my friends or anything. That would be a bad idea. That was just the most deep down thought that I had. Was just don't let anybody find out that you don't have control of this shit. And so I didn't. I would try to go here or there for help, but I wouldn't, you know, tell the people around me. I just couldn't do it. And I don't know why I was so indignant about that. I mean, I know why I was so indignant about it with my family, but my family was, they were very, sort of like their attitude was, I mean, they drank, but they didn't drink alcoholically, and it was in very bad taste to drink too much. That was just a lack of control, and that was just bad behavior. And people that had drug problems, that was just real unfortunate. They had gotten in with the wrong people, and, you know, that poor thing, they got in trouble with drugs, and isn't that awful and everything? But if you drank too much, That was on you. And that was kind of how it was with the family. And so I didn't want to, you know, be ashamed with my family. And so I really did not want them to find out that I felt that way. And so I went along like that for a long time. And I would try to quit. I might be able to quit for like maybe 30 days or so. And I just hang on by my fingernails, and then when I couldn't do it anymore, and I'd start again, it would just be like, well, screw it, you know, I can't do this. And if I can't do it, then I may as well just go all the way. So just be this swinging pendulum of, you know, hanging on by my fingernails, not drinking at all, to just, woo, you know, off the rails. And I did that for so long. And so, I mean, I don't really know I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what my bottom was. I like to say that my ass just dragged along the bottom for a really long time. And I did that for a long time and just lived badly. But I had some fun while I was doing it too, I've got to say. But I would have to maintain. I was just so saturated with alcohol that I just had to kind of maintain a certain level to function. And so generally I would get up in the morning and I would have the first, sit on the edge of the bed and have the first drink in the dark. And then I'd fix the second drink and get in the shower with it, you know. And then I would have to drink a certain pace through the day and then to stay functional and not get too drunk. And then at night I could kind of go, you know, accelerate a little bit. But there would come a point where at night when it's time to stop, you know, I like to say that most people, you know, if you're partying or you're out or whatever, most people reach a point where they stop drinking and go home. They either get tired or they have enough or whatever. They stop drinking and go home. I would have to go home and finish drinking. You know, there comes that point when you're that drunk that you need to finish by yourself. You know, and one of the things that getting sober has done for me is it's, when you go past the getting sober and you get to the relationships, you know, and being able to make relationships with people, that's one of the big things that AA has done for me. Because when you drink like that, you don't have real relationships with people. Because when you drink like that, there's so much of yourself that you can't show people, you know, that you just have this barrier. Because there's so much of yourself you don't really want people to see. And I had that going on for a long time. And I didn't have good relationships with people because I kept people at a distance, you know, out of the necessary. And just because I wasn't good with people, you know, and that just doesn't work well at some point. And so, you know, I would need to do what I wanted to do. And frankly, we were talking in a meeting the other day about, and we were laughing about being spontaneous. and I was laughing and telling them that during this sort of drinking time for me, I would get an urge to eat at the Varsity. I'd get an urge for the Varsity, you know, so I'd go to the Varsity and I'd just load up, you know, chili dogs and everything. But the problem was I didn't live in Atlanta at the time. I would just be stone drunk, and it might be whatever time, and I would get the urge for the Varsity. I might drive 2 hours, you know, just drunk as a skunk. Go, and I would, what I didn't say the other day was that one of the times I was going down the highway, you know, leaving, getting on the interstate, and there were these guys in this car beside me, you know, and they started chatting me up. And I decided I'd share my food because I am a happy drunk. And I was like, oh, yeah, you want some fries? We're going, you know, probably 80 down the highway, sharing Varsity out the window of the car, you know. And I'm like, I don't know, totally fried. But I would just, on my own, drunk as a skunk, drive ever how far away I need to drive, come to Atlanta to have some Varsity, and without giving it any thought. And that's a funny story, but that was my entire existence. It's like it was a string of irresponsible, selfish, ridiculous decisions based on what I wanted because I didn't think about anything else. And if people didn't like that about me or they got in my way, then I would say or do whatever I needed to do to back you off, you know, to get you to go away. And I had a lot of people go away. And so I didn't do relationships very well. But like I said, I went to that first AA meeting when I was 18. And that was in 1980. And so if you if you are good at math, I've been sober for 17 years. First meeting was in 1980. Not necessarily a fast learner. But I did at one point stop drinking on my own. I didn't go to AA regularly, but I did it because I fell in love with somebody and I actually wanted someone to stay in my life. And I knew that I was going to screw it up. And so, like it says in the big book, you know, if you want something badly enough, or if you have a good enough reason, sometimes you can put it down. And I did put it down. But I could not ever stop thinking about it. And when people drank around me, it was like all I saw was the alcohol. All I thought about was the alcohol. Why can't I drink like, you know, why can't I drink, you know? And so, you know, when I talk about it today, when I talk about being in AA, I say I'm here because I can't successfully drink and I can't successfully not drink. And so when I came in this time, I was ready to put aside the things that had made it not work for me before, which was a lot of it was the God thing. I had a problem with having to surrender to God. I had a problem with having to talk about and hear about God, because that was something that made me sort of, you know, bristle up, you know, because God was something I grew up with and that had never taken with me. And it was something that was, that I had decided was a judgmental thing, and that I had decided did not judge me very well for various reasons. And so I didn't see how that was going to work for me. And I couldn't see past how I could do that, how I could make that work for me. But when I came back in here this last time, I had decided that I was just going to come in and do what they told me to do and listen and stop fighting. And so I did. And I got a sponsor who was nothing like me. She just was the person who volunteered to be my sponsor that day. She said, "You want me to be your sponsor?" And I said, "Yes," because I decided I wasn't going to say no. I wasn't going to, you know, say no to anything. I wasn't going to be particular and contrary and all that. So when she said that, I said yes. And she was very meek and mild and just the sweetest little lady ever, and was probably perfect. She ended up leaving our group. Our group split when I had about 9 months. And she ended up leaving, and I ended up staying. So she was only my sponsor for that period of time. But she got me through the first three steps. You know, she got me through that part probably like nobody else could have. She was perfect for that. And she was there and was put, you know, there that day in my life, I think, for that reason. And she just, you know, opened my eyes to the fact that it doesn't have to be the way that I thought it had to be. And now I have a relationship with my higher power. I call my higher power God because I wasn't going to fight it. That's the only reason. You know, I wasn't going to not call it God because that would be being contrary. So I call my higher power God. But, you know, I still don't know exactly what that power is. I don't worry about it too much. I just know that there is something that works in my life. I've seen that happen through through things that have happened here, like the obsession to drink leaving me. That is certainly something that never happened in my life before. I tried everything and any time that I was drinking, any time that I was not drinking, no matter what I did in all those years, I never managed to get the obsession to drink to leave me. There was nothing I could do. And working the steps of AA, the obsession to drink left. And that was one of the first things that really made me feel like there was a power in my life, you know, something bigger than me. And I do believe that part of it is the people in these rooms and the power of talking one alcoholic to another. You know, it doesn't, you know, for me, God doesn't have to be a God. You know, it's just, you know, it's just my higher power. And I like a passage in the back of the big book in the spiritual experience that says, having a spiritual experience is just the coming to a point where you are of a mindset to be able to become sober. You know, where you open your mind, not those words, but where you become of a mindset to be able to become sober. And I did that. So I feel like I had a spiritual experience, certainly had a spiritual experience in those terms. And I've had a few, many spiritual experiences along the way that have confirmed that for me. And so I do feel like I have a relationship with a higher power. But working the steps has brought me not only to some level of sobriety, but the emotional sobriety and the ability to deal with people, the ability to try to form relationships. Because before, it was like everything stopped here for me. And I don't know why. I don't know how I got there completely, but I just didn't know how to let people in my life. And I didn't know how to get invested in theirs, really. And it's still kind of hard for me. It's still not a real natural thing for me to get close to people. But it's easier now. But, you know, beforehand, I just really couldn't go there. I just couldn't get past a certain point with people. And I couldn't feel a certain closeness with people. And I didn't really even want to. And I don't know if it was a fear or what, but just going through the steps and being in this fellowship has helped me be able to create relationships that are real with people. And that's been huge. And it's allowed me to be able to be the kind of person that can be there for people. I lost both my parents in 2016, 9 months apart, and just to be able to be there for that was just an incredible experience for me, because it was so uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable to just be there and wait. It's uncomfortable to wait for someone to die. Mm-hmm. And just be there and wait it out. And before this, I would have been anywhere else. You know, I would have gotten up. I would have had to get up and I got to get out of this room. I got to, you know. But I could be there and I could do what I needed to do. And I could be there for my parents. And I could be there for my siblings. And I could just be present. And that was a miracle, because that was not something that I would have been able to do before I was sober. Just to be able to take responsibility and be able to sit in the uncomfortableness of what you need to do. And so I'm really grateful for that. And I'm grateful for a lot of things today, and gratefulness is a new thing for me too. When I first came into the program, people were using words I didn't really have a point of reference for, like gratitude and being blessed and things like that, and I didn't really have a real point of reference for that. I've always felt like I was really lucky. You know, I've always known I was lucky. You know, just the whole deal with my family and how I was able to grow up and things that have happened to me. I've always known that I was a lucky person, and I could always feel lucky. Like, you know, if I got drunk and raced a train and I won, I felt lucky. I was lucky, man. I'm lucky I beat that train. You know, and or if I did something and I got away with it, you know, I felt really lucky. I'm lucky, man. That cop didn't catch me, you know, or whatever. And I could feel lucky, but I didn't feel blessed, you know, and I didn't feel grateful. And I think it was because everything was here. You know, there was nothing here but right here. Nothing went in and nothing went out. And understanding sort of this relationship with the higher power and everything that I've been through and being where I am now and being able to look at it from this point, I understand now that gratitude is different than being thankful. As gratitude goes somewhere. You know, I'm grateful to something. That goes somewhere. And a feeling of being blessed comes from somewhere. You know, it's not just here about me anymore. You know, there's other things out there. And I'm accepting that my life doesn't begin and end right here anymore. And so that's a big thing for me. But I do feel a lot of gratitude every day now, and I do feel like I am the luckiest, most blessed person in the world every day. Just to be here, I mean, I should be dead 100 times over, like most of us in here. But beyond that, just to be where I am today, I have so much and so many beautiful people in my life and so much to be grateful for. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has really put me in a position to be here in that and to see it for what it is and to be grateful for it. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for all of you being here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Of being free, give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't want to see, I misunderstood your words to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, since even darkness could be a light. Oh, and I remember that all the dreams I made in the night, and I tell myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child.